She said it. Vasya, heavy-eyed and repentant, murmured,
I'm sorry, Dunya. Sorry. Sorry.
She was rubbed with horrible mustard seed and beaten with quick, whisking birch branches to liven her blood. They wrapped her in wool, bandaged her skinned hand, and poured soup down her throat.
It was very wicked, Vasya, Olga said.
She smoothed her sister's hair and cradled her on her lap. Vasya was already asleep.
Enough for tonight, Dunya, Olga added. Tomorrow is soon enough for more talk. Vasya was put to bed atop the oven, and Dunya laid down beside her.
When at last her sister slept, Olga sank down limp beside the fire. Her father and brothers sat spooning up their stew in a corner, wearing identical thunderous expressions.
She'll be all right, said Olga. I do not think she'll take a chill.
But any man might, was called from his hearth to look for her, snapped Pyotr. Or I might, said Kolya. A man wants his dinner after a day of mending his father's roof, not a night's ride by torchlight. I'll belt her tomorrow.
And so, retorted Sasha coolly.
She's been belted before. It is not the task of men to manage girl children. It wants a woman. Dunya is old. Olya will marry soon. And then the old lady will be left alone to raise the child.
Pyotr said nothing. 6 years since he put his wife in the earth, and he had not thought of another, though there were many who would have heard his suit. But his daughter had frightened him. When Kolya had sought his bed, and he and Sasha sat together in the dark, watching the candle burn low before the icon, Pyotr said,
Would you see your mother forgotten?
Vasya never knew her, rejoined Sasha, but a woman of sense, not a sister or a kindly old nurse, will do her good. She will soon be unmanageable, father.
A long pause.
It is not Vasya's fault mother died, added Sasha, lower.
Pyotr said nothing, and Sasha rose, bowed to his father, and blew out the candle. Chapter 4. The Grand Prince of Muscovy. Pyotr thrashed his daughter the next day, and she wept, though he was not cruel. She was forbidden to leave the village, but for once that was no hardship. She had taken the threatened chill, and she had nightmares in which she revisited a one-eyed man, a horse, and a stranger in a clearing in the woods. Sasha, though he told no one, ranged the forest to the west, looking for this one-eyed man, or an oak tree with roots about its knees. But never man nor tree did he find. And then the snow fell for 3 days, straight and hard, so that none went out. Their lives drew in, as always in the winter, a round of food and sleep and small drowsy chores. The snow mounded up outside, and on a bitter evening, Pyotr sat on his own stool, smoothing a straight piece of ash for an axe handle. His face was set like stone, for he was remembering what he had pleased to forget.
Take care of her, Marina had said so many years ago, as the tinge of mortal illness spread over her lovely face. I chose her. She is important. Petya, promise me.
Pyotr, grieving, had promised. But then his wife had let go his hand, had lain back in her bed, and her eyes had looked beyond him. She smiled once, soft and joyful, but Pyotr did not think the look was for him. She did not speak again, and died in the gray hour before dawn.
And then, Pyotr thought, they made ready a hole to receive her, and I bellowed at the women who tried to bar me from the death chamber. I myself, I wrapped her cold flesh that stank still of blood, and with my own two hands put her in the ground.
All that winter, his infant daughter had screamed, and he could not bear to look the baby in the face, because her mother had chosen the child and not him.
Well, now he must make amends. Pyotr squinted at his axe handle.
I am going to Moscow when the rivers freeze, he said into the silence.
The room erupted in exclamations. Vasya, who had been drowsing, heavy with fever and hot honey wine, squeaked and poked her head over the side of the oven.
To Moscow, father? Asked Kolya. Again?
Pyotr's lips thinned. He had gone to Moscow in that first bitter winter after Marina's death. Ivan Ivanovich, Marina's half-brother, was Grand Prince, and for his family's sake, Pyotr had salvaged what he could of their connection. But he had taken no woman, then or later.
You mean to marry this time, said Sasha.
Pyotr nodded curtly, feeling the weight of his family's stare. There were women enough in the provinces, but a Muscovite lady would bring alliances and money. Ivan's indulgence for the husband of his dead sister would not last forever, and for his small daughter's sake, he needed a new wife. But,
Marina, what a fool I am, to think I cannot bear it.
Sasha and Kolya, you will come with me, Pyotr said.
Delight quite overspread the censure on his son's faces.
To Moscow, father? Asked Kolya.
It is 2 weeks riding, if all goes well, said Pyotr. I will need you on the road, and you have never been to court. The Grand Prince ought to know your faces.
There was chaos in the kitchen then, as the boys exchanged delighted exclamations. Vasya and Alyosha both clamored to go. Olga begged for jewels and good cloth. The elder boys retorted gloatingly, and in arguing, pleading, and speculation, the evening passed. The snow fell thrice, deep and solid after midwinter, and after the last snowfall came a great blue frost, when men felt their breath stop in their nostrils and weak things grew apt to die in the night. That meant the sledge roads were open, the roads that ran down snow-covered rivers, smooth as glass, and sparkled over dirt tracks that, in summer, were a misery of ruts and broken axles. The boys watched the sky and felt of the frost and took to pacing the house, oiling their greasy boots and scraping the hair-fine edges of their spears. At last the day came. Pyotr and his sons rose in the dark and spilled into the dooryard as soon as it grew light. The men were gathered already. The keen dawn reddened their faces, their beasts stamped and snorted clouds of steam. A man had saddled Buran, Pyotr's evil-tempered Mongol stallion, and was clinging, white-knuckled, to the beast's headstall. Pyotr slapped his waiting mount, dodged the snapping teeth, and swung into the saddle. His grateful attendant fell back, gasping. Pyotr kept half an eye on his unpredictable stallion. The rest was for the seeming chaos around him. The stable yard seethed with bodies, with beasts, with sledges. Furs lay mounded beside boxes of beeswax and candles. The jars of mead and honey jostled for room with bundles of dried provisions. Kolya was directing the loading of the last sledge, his nose red in the morning chill. He had his mother's black eyes. The serving girls giggled as he passed. A basket fell with a thud and a puff of dry snow, almost under the feet of a sledge horse. The beast shied forward and sideways. Kolya sprang out of the way, and Pyotr started forward, but Sasha was before them. He was off his mare like a cat, and next instant had caught the horse by its headstall, talking into its ear. The horse stilled, looking abashed. Pyotr watched as Sasha pointed, said something. The men hurried to take the horse's rein and seize the offending basket. Sasha said something else, grinning, and they all laughed. The boy remounted his mare. His seat was better than his brother's. He had an affinity for horses, and he bore his sword with grace.
A warrior born, thought Piotr, and a leader of men. Marina, I am fortunate in my sons.
Olga ran out the kitchen door, Vasya trotting in her footsteps. The girls' embroidered sarafans stood out against the snow. Olga held her apron in both hands. Piled within were dark, tender loaves, hot from the oven. Kolya and Sasha were already converging. Vasya tugged on her second brother's cloak while he ate his loaf.
But why may I not come, Sashka? She said. I will cook your supper for you. Dunya showed me how. I can ride your horse with you. I am small enough.
She clung to his cloak with both hands.
Not this year, little frog, Sasha said. You are small. Too small.
Seeing her eyes sad, he knelt in the snow beside her and pressed the remainder of his bread into her hand.
Eat and grow strong, little sister, he said, so that you are fitted for journeys. God keep you.
He put a hand on her head, then sprang again to the back of his brown mish.
Sashka!
Cried Vasya, but he was away, calling swift orders to the men loading the last wagon. Olga took her sister's hand and tugged. Come on, Vasochka, she said when the child dragged her feet. The girls ran up to Piotr. The last loaf was cooling in Olga's hand. Safe journey, father, Olga said.
How little my Olya is like her mother, Piotr thought, for all she has her face. Just as well. Marina was like a hawk in a cage. Olga is gentler. I will make her a fine marriage.
He smiled down at his daughters.
God keep you both, he said. Perhaps I will bring you a husband, Olya.
Vasya made a sound like a muted growl. Olga blushed and laughed and almost dropped the bread. Piotr stooped in time to seize it and was glad he had. She had slit the crust and spooned honey inside to melt in the heat. He tore off a great hunk, his teeth were still good, and paused, blissfully chewing.
And you, Vasya, he added stern, mind your sister and stay near the house.
Yes, father, said Vasya.
But she looked longingly at the riding horses. Piotr wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. The mob had come to something resembling order.
Farewell, my daughters, he said. We are going. Mind the sledges.
Olga nodded, a little wistful. Vasya did not nod at all. She looked mutinous. There was a chorus of shouting, the cracking of whips, and then they were away. Behind them, Olga and Vasilisa stood alone in the dooryard, listening to the bells on the wagons, until they were swallowed up by the morning. 2 weeks after setting out, with plenty of delay but no disaster, Piotr and his sons passed the outer rings of Moscow, that seething, jumped-up trading post on a hill beside the Moskva River. They smelled the city long before they saw it, hazed as it was with the smoke of 10,000 fires. And then the brilliant domes, green and scarlet and cobalt, showed dimly through the vapor. At last they saw the city itself, lusty and squalid, like a fair woman with feet caked in filth. The high golden towers rose proudly above the desperate poor, and the gold-fretted icons watched, inscrutable, while princes and farmers' wives came to kiss their stiff faces and pray. The streets were all snowy mud, churned by innumerable feet. Beggars, their noses winter blackened, clutched at the boys' stirrups. Kolya kicked them off, but Sasha clasped their grimy hands. The red winter sun was tilting west when at last they came, weary and mud-splattered, to a massive wooden gate, bound in bronze and topped with towers. A dozen spearmen watched the road, with archers on the wall. They looked coldly at Piotr, his sledges, and his sons. But Piotr passed their captain a jar of good mead, and instantly the hard faces softened. Piotr bowed, first to the captain and then to his men. and the guards waved them through in a chorus of compliments. The Kremlin was a town in itself. Palaces, huts, stables, smithies, and countless half-built churches. Though the original walls had been built with a double thickness of oak, the years had rotted the timber to matchwood. Marina's half-brother, the Grand Prince Ivan Ivanovich, had commissioned the replacement with walls more massive still. The air reeked of the clay that had been caked on the timber, meager protection against fire. Everywhere carpenters called back and forth, shaking sawdust from their beards. Servants, priests, boyars, guardsmen, and merchants milled about, bickering. Tatars riding fine horses rubbed shoulders with Russian merchants directing laden sledges. Each broke out shouting at the other on the slightest pretext. Kolya gawked at the crush, masking nervousness with a high head. His horse jerked at its rider's touch on the reins. Pyotr had been to Moscow before. A few peremptory words, unearthed stabling for their horses, and a place for their wagons.
"See to the horses," he said to Oleg, the steadiest of his men. "Do not leave them."
There were idle servants on all sides, narrow-eyed merchants, and boyars in barbaric finery. A horse would disappear in an instant and be forever lost. Oleg nodded, and one rough fingertip grazed the hilt of his long knife. They had sent word of their coming. The messenger met them outside the stable.
"You are summoned, my lord," he said to Pyotr. "The Grand Prince is at table and greets his brother from the north."
The road from Lesnaya Zemlya had been long. Pyotr was grimed, bruised, cold, and weary.
"Very well," he said curtly. "We are coming. Leave that."
The last was to Sasha, who was digging balled-up ice out of his horse's hoof. They splashed frigid water on their grimy faces, drew on caftans of thick wool and hats of shining sable, and laid aside their swords. The fortress town was a warren of churches and wooden palaces. The ground churned to muck, the air smarting with smoke. Pyotr followed the messenger with a quick step. Behind him, Sasha gazed narrow-eyed at the gilded domes and painted towers. Kolya was scarcely less circumspect, though he stared more at the fine horses and the weapons of the men who rode them. They came to a double door of oak that opened onto a hall packed full of men and crawling with dogs. The great tables groaned with good things. On the far end of the hall, on a high carven seat, sat a man with bright hair, eating slices off the joint that lay dripping before him. Ivan II was styled Ivan Krasny, or Ivan the Fair. He was no longer young, perhaps 30. His elder brother Semyon had ruled before him, but Semyon and his issue had all died of plague in one bitter summer. The Grand Prince of Moscow was indeed very fair. His hair gleamed like palest honey. Women swarmed around this prince's golden beauty. He was also a skilled hunter and a master of hounds and horses. His table creaked under a great roast boar, crusted with herbs. Pyotr's sons swallowed. They were all hungry after 2 weeks on the wintry road. Pyotr strode across the vast hall, his sons behind. The prince did not look up from his dinner, though calculating or merely curious stares assailed them from all sides. A fireplace large enough to roast an ox burned behind the prince's dais, throwing Ivan's face into shadow and gilding the faces of guests. Pyotr and his sons came before the dais, halted and bowed. Ivan speared a gobbet of pork with the tip of his knife. Blood stained his yellow beard.
"Pyotr Vladimirovich, is it not?"
he said slowly, chewing. His shadowed gaze swept them from hat to boots.
"The one that married my half-sister?"
He took a swallow of honey wine and added,
"May she rest in peace."
"Yes, Ivan Ivanovich," said Pyotr.
"Well met, brother,"
said the prince. He tossed a bone to the cur beneath his chair.
What brings you so far?
I wish to present you my sons, Gosudar, said Pyotr. Your nephews. They are men soon to wed. And if God wills, I desire also to find a woman of my own, so my youngest children need no longer go motherless.
A worthy aim, said Ivan. Are these your sons?
His gaze flicked out to the boys behind Pyotr.
Yes. Nikolai Petrovich, my eldest, and my second son, Alexander.
Kolya and Sasha stepped forward. The Grand Prince gave them the same sweeping look he'd given Pyotr. His glance lingered on Sasha. The boy had the merest scrapings of a beard and the jutting bones of a boy half-grown, but he was light on his feet, and the gray eyes did not waver.
We are well met, kinsmen, said Ivan,
not taking his eyes off Pyotr's younger son.
You, boy, you are like your mother.
Sasha, taken aback, bowed and said nothing. There was a moment's silence. Then, louder, Ivan added,
Pyotr Vladimirovich, you are welcome in my house and at my table until your business is done.
The prince inclined his head abruptly and returned to his roast. Dismissed, the three were left to take three hastily cleared places at the high table. Kolya needed no encouragement. Hot juices were still running down the roast pig's sides. The pie oozed with cheese and dried mushrooms. The round guest loaf lay in the middle of the table, beside the prince's good gray salt. Kolya fell to at once, but Sasha paused. Such a look the Grand Prince gave me, father, he said, as though he knew my thoughts better than I do.
They are all like that, the princes that live, said Pyotr.
He took a steaming slice of pie.
They all have too many brothers, and all are eager for the next city, the richer prize. Either they are good judges of men, or they are dead. Go wary of the living ones, Sinok, because they are dangerous.
Then he gave his full attention to the pastry. Sasha furrowed his brow, but he let his plate be filled. Their journey had been an endless round of strange stews and hard flat cakes, broken once or twice by their neighbor's hospitality. The Grand Prince kept a good table, and they all feasted until they could hold no more. After, the party was given three rooms for their use, chilly and crawling with vermin, but they were too tired to care. Pyotr saw to the settling of the wagons and of his men for the night, then collapsed on the high bed and surrendered to a dreamless sleep. Chapter 5. The Holy Man of Makovets Hill. Father, said Sasha, vibrating with excitement, the priest says there's a holy man north of Moscow, on Makovets Hill. He has founded a monastery and gathered already 11 disciples. They say he talks with angels. Every day many go to seek his blessing. Pyotr grunted. He had been in Moscow a week already, enduring the business of currying favor. His latest effort, only just concluded, had been a visit to the Tatar emissary, the Baskak. No man from Sarai, that jewel-box city built by the conquering horde, would deign to be impressed by the paltry offerings of a northern lord. But Pyotr had doggedly pressed furs upon him. Heaps of fox and ermine, rabbit and sable passed beneath the emissary's calculating gaze until at last he looked less condescending and thanked Pyotr with every appearance of goodwill. Such furs fetched much gold in the court of the Khan, and further south, among the princes of Byzantium. It was worth it, thought Pyotr. I might be glad one day to have a friend among the conquerors. Pyotr was weary and sweating in his gold-threaded finery, but he could not rest, for here was his second son on fire with eagerness, bearing a tale of holy men and miracles.
There are always holy men, Pyotr said to Sasha.
He
He knew a sudden longing for quiet and for plain food. The Muscovites were fond of Byzantine cookery, and the resulting collision with Russian ingredients did his stomach no favors. Tonight, there was to be more feasting and more intrigue. He still sought a wife for himself and a husband for Olga.
"Father," said Sasha, "I should like to go to this monastery, if I may."
"Sashka, you cannot cast a stone without hitting a church in this city," said Pyotr. "Why waste 3 days riding on another?"
Sasha's lip curled. "In Moscow, priests are in love with their standing. They eat fat meat and preach poverty to the miserable."
This was true. But Pyotr, though a good lord to his people, lacked an abstract sense of justice. He shrugged.
"Your holy men might be the same."
"Nonetheless, I should like to see. Please, Father."
Sasha, though gray-eyed, had his mother's jet brows and long lashes. They swept down, oddly delicate against his thin face. Pyotr considered. Roads were dangerous, but the well-traveled road running north from Moscow was not markedly so. He had no desire to raise a timid son.
"Take 5 men and 2 dozen candles. That should ensure your reception."
A light came into the boy's face. Pyotr's mouth tightened. Marina was bone in the unyielding earth. But he had seen her look just that way when her soul lit her face like firelight.
"Thank you, Father," the boy said.
He dashed out the door and away, lithe as a weasel. Pyotr heard him in the dvor before the palace, calling the men, calling for his horse.
"Marina," said Pyotr low, "thank you for my sons."
The Trinity Lavra had been carved out of the wilderness. Though the feet of passing pilgrims had beaten a path through the snowy forest, the trees still pressed close on either side, dwarfing the bell tower of the plain wooden church. Sasha was reminded of his own village at Lesnaya Zemlya. A sturdy palisade surrounded the monastery, which was composed mostly of small wooden buildings. The air smelled of smoke and baking bread. Oleg had ridden with him, the head of his attendants.
"We can't all go in," said Sasha, reining his horse.
Oleg nodded. The whole party dismounted, bits jingling.
"You and you," Oleg said. "Watch the road."
The men chosen settled beside the path, loosened the horses' girths, and began searching for firewood. The others passed between the 2 uprights of a narrow, unbarred gate. Great trees threw sooty shadows onto the raw wood of the little church. A slim man ducked out of a doorway, wiping floury hands. He was not very tall and not very old. His broad nose was set between large, liquid eyes, the green-brown of a forest pool. He wore the coarse robe of a monk, splattered with flour. Sasha knew him. The monk might have been wearing the rags of a beggar or the robes of a bishop, and Sasha would still have known him. The boy dropped to his knees in the snow. The monk pulled up short.
"What brings you here, my son?"
Sasha could barely bring himself to look up.
"I would ask your blessing, Batyushka," he managed.
The monk raised a brow.
"You needn't call me so. I am not ordained. We are all children of God."
"We brought candles for the altar," Sasha stammered, still on his knees. A thin, brown, work-hardened hand thrust itself under Sasha's elbow and raised him to his feet. The 2 were nearly of a height, though the boy was broader of shoulder and not yet full grown, gangly as a colt.
"We kneel to God alone here," said the monk.
He studied Sasha's face a moment. "I am making the altar bread for services tonight," he added abruptly. "Come and help me." Sasha nodded, wordless, and waved his men off. The kitchen was rude and hot from the oven. The flour and water and salt lay to hand, to be mixed, kneaded, and baked in the ashes. The two worked in silence for a time, but it was an easy silence. Peace lay thick on that place. The monk's questions were so mild that the boy hardly noticed he was being questioned, but, a little clumsy with the unaccustomed task, he rolled out dough and related his history, his father's rank, his mother's death, their journey to Moscow.
"And you came here," the monk finished for him. "What are you seeking, my son?"
Sasha opened his mouth and closed it again.
I do not know," he admitted shamefaced. "Something."
To his surprise, the monk laughed.
"Do you wish to stay then?"
Sasha could only stare.
"It is a hard life we lead here," the monk went on more seriously. "You would build your own cell, plant your garden, bake your bread, aid your brothers as necessary. But there is peace here, peace beyond anything. I see you have felt it."
Seeing Sasha still dumbfounded, he said,
"Yes. Yes, many pilgrims come here, and many of them ask to stay. But we take only the seekers who do not know what they are looking for."
"Yes," Sasha said at last, slowly.
"Yes, I would like to stay, very much." "Very well," said Sergei Radonezhsky, and turned back to his baking.
They pressed the horses hard on the road back to Moscow. Oleg mistrusted the fiery look on his young lord's face. He rode close to Sasha's stirrup and resolved to speak to Pyotr. But the young lord reached his father first. They rode into the city in the midst of the brief burning sunset, with the towers of church and palace silhouetted against a violet sky. Sasha left his horse steaming in the dvor and ran at once up the stairs to his father's rooms. He found both father and brother dressing.
"Well met, little brother," said Kolya when Sasha came in. "Have you done with churches yet?"
He threw Sasha a quick, tolerant glance and returned his attention to his clothes. Tongue between his lips, he settled a hat of black sable rakishly on his black hair.
"Well, you are in good time. Wash off the stink. We are feasting tonight, and it may be the family will show us the woman father is to marry. She has all her teeth. I have it on good authority. And a pleasant..." "What, Sasha?"
"Sergei Radonezhsky has asked me to join his monastery on Makovets Hill," repeated Sasha louder. Kolya looked blank. "I wish to be a monk," Sasha said.
That got their attention. Pyotr was drawing on his red-heeled boots. He slewed round to stare at his son and nearly tripped.
"Why?" cried Kolya in tones of deep horror.
Sasha clamped his teeth on several uncharitable remarks. His brother had already cut a large swath through the palace serving women.
"To dedicate my life to God," he informed Kolya, with a touch of superiority.
"I see your holy man made quite an impression," Pyotr said, before the astonished Kolya had recovered.
He had regained his balance and was drawing his second boot on, with perhaps a bit more vim than necessary.
Yes, he did, father."
"Very well. You may," said Pyotr.
Kolya gaped. Pyotr put his foot down and stood. His caftan was ochre and rust. The gold rings on his hands caught the candlelight. His hair and beard had been combed with scented oil. He looked both imposing and uncomfortable. Sasha, who had been expecting a drawn-out battle, stared at his father.
"On two conditions," Pyotr added.
"What are they?"
"One, you may not visit this holy man again until you go to join his order. That will only be after next year's harvest, when you will have had a year to reflect. Two, you must remember that as a monk, your inheritance will go to your brothers, and you will have naught but your prayers to sustain you."
Sasha swallowed hard. But, Father, if I might only see him again...
No!
Pyotr cut him off in a tone that brooked no argument.
You may turn monk if you will, but you will do it with your eyes open, not enthralled by the words of a hermit.
Sasha nodded reluctantly. Very well, Father, he said.
Pyotr, his face a little grimmer than usual, turned without another word and strode down the stairs to where the horses waited, drowsing in the faded evening light.
Chapter 6 Demons. Ivan Krasny had only one son, the small blonde wildcat Dmitry Ivanovich. Alexei, Metropolitan of Moscow, the highest prelate in Rus, ordained by the Patriarch of Constantinople himself, was charged with teaching the boy letters and statecraft. Some days, Alexei thought the job was beyond anyone short of a wonder worker. 3 hours already, the boys had labored over the birch bark. Dmitri with his elder cousin, Vladimir Andreevich, the young Prince of Serpukhov. They scuffled, they spilled things.
Might as well ask the palace cats, thought Alexei, despairing, to sit and attend. Father! Cried Dmitri. Father!
Ivan Ivanovich came through the door. Both boys sprang off their stools and bowed, pushing each other.
Get you gone, my sons, said Ivan. I would speak with the Holy Father.
The boys disappeared on the instant. Alexei sank into a chair by the oven and poured out a large measure of mead.
How is my son? Said Ivan, drawing up the chair opposite.
The prince and the metropolitan had known each other a long time. Alexei had been loyal even before the death of Semyon assured Ivan the throne.
Bold, fair, charming, flighty as a butterfly, said Alexei. He will be a good prince if he lives so long. Why have you come to me, Ivan Ivanovich?
Anna, said Ivan succinctly.
The metropolitan frowned.
Is she getting worse?
No, but she'll never be any better. She is growing too old to lurk around the palace and make folk nervous.
Anna Ivanovna was the only child of Ivan's first marriage. The girl's mother was dead, and her stepmother hated the sight of her. The people muttered when she passed and crossed themselves. There are convents enough, returned Alexei. It is a simple matter.
No convent in Moscow, said Ivan. My wife won't have it. She says the girl will cause talk if she stays near. Madness is a shameful thing in a line of princes. She must be sent away.
I will arrange it if you like, said Alexei wearily.
Already he arranged many things for this prince.
She can go south. Give an abbess enough gold, and she will take Anna and hide her lineage in the bargain. My thanks, father, said Ivan, and poured more wine.
However, I think you have a larger problem, added Alexei.
Numerous ones,
said the grand prince, gulping his wine. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
Which were you referring to?
The metropolitan jerked his chin in the direction of the door, where the two princes had gone.
Young Vladimir Andreevich, he said. The prince of Serpukhov. His family wants him married.
Ivan was unimpressed.
Plenty of time for that. He is only 13.
Alexei shook his head. They have a princess of Litva in mind, the duke's second daughter. Remember, Vladimir is also a grandson of Ivan Kalita, and he is older than your Dmitri. Well married and full grown, he would have a better claim to Moscow than your own son, should you die untimely.
Ivan grew pale with anger. They dare not! I am the grand prince and Dmitri is my son!
And so... said Alexei, unmoved.
The Khan heeds the claims of princes only as long as they suit his ends. The strongest prince gets the patent. That is how the horde assures peace in its territories.
Ivan reflected.
What then?
See Vladimir wed to another woman, said Alexei at once. Not a princess,
but not one so low-born as to cause insult. If she is beautiful, the boy is young enough to swallow it.
Ivan reflected, sipping his wine and biting his fingers.
Pyotr Vladimirovich is lord of rich lands, he said at last. His daughter is my own niece, and she will have a great dowry. She cannot fail to be a beauty. My sister was very beautiful, and her mother charmed my father into marriage, though she came to Moscow a beggar.
Alexei's eyes sparked. He tugged his brown beard.
Yes, he said. I had heard that Pyotr Vladimirovich was in Moscow in search of a wife for himself as well.
Yes, said Ivan. He surprised everyone. It is 7 years since my sister died. No one thought he would marry again.
Well then, said Alexei, if he is looking for a wife, what if you gave him your daughter?
Ivan put down his cup in some surprise.
Anna will be well hidden in the northern woods, Alexei continued. And will Vladimir Andreevich dare refuse Pyotr's daughter then? A girl so closely connected to the throne? It would be an insult to you.
Ivan frowned.
Anna wants, most particularly, to go to a convent.
Alexei shrugged.
And so?
Pyotr Vladimirovich is not a cruel man. She will be happy enough.
Think of your son, Ivan Ivanovich.
A demon sat sewing in the corner, and she was the only one who saw. Anna Ivanovna clutched at the cross between her breasts. Eyes shut, she whispered,
"Go away. Go away. Please go away."
She opened her eyes. The demon was still there, but now two of her women were staring at her. Everyone else was looking with studied interest at the sewing in their laps. Anna tried not to let her eyes dart again to the corner, but she couldn't help it. The demon sat on its stool, oblivious. Anna shuddered. The heavy linen shirt lay on her lap like a dead thing. She thrust her hands into its sleek folds to hide her trembling. A serving woman slipped into the room. Anna hastily took up her needle and was surprised when the worn bast shoes stopped in front of her.
Anna Ivanovna, you are summoned to your father.
Anna stared. Her father had not summoned her for the better part of a year. She sat a moment bewildered, then jumped to her feet. Swiftly she changed her plain sarafan to one of crimson and ochre, drawing it over her grimy skin, trying to ignore the stink of her long chestnut braid. The Rus liked to be clean. In winter, scarce a week went by when her half-sisters did not visit the bathhouses, but there was a little pot-bellied devil in there that grinned at them through the steam. Anna tried to point him out, but her sisters saw nothing. At first they took it for her imagination, later for foolishness, and at last just looked at her sideways and didn't say anything at all. So Anna had learned not to mention the eyes in the bathhouse, just as she never mentioned the bald creature sewing in the corner. But she would look sometimes. She couldn't help it, and she never went to the bathhouse unless her stepmother dragged or shamed her into it. Anna unraveled and replaited her greasy hair and touched the cross over her breast. She was the most devout of all her sisters. Everyone said so. What they didn't know was that in church there were only the unearthly faces of the icons. No demons haunted her there, and she'd have lived in a church if she could, shielded by incense and painted eyes. The oven was hot in her stepmother's workroom, and the grand prince stood beside it, sweating in winter finery. He wore his usual acerbic expression, though his eyes sparkled. His wife sat beside the fire, her thin plait straggling out from beneath her high headdress. Her needles lay forgotten in her lap. Anna halted a few paces away and bent her head. Husband and wife looked her over in silence. Finally, her father spoke to her stepmother.
"Glory of God, woman," he said,
sounding annoyed.
Can you not get the girl to bathe? She looks as though she's been living with pigs.
It doesn't matter, her mother replied, if she is already promised. Anna had been staring at her toes like a well-bred maiden, but now her head shot up.
Promised? She whispered,
hating the way her voice rose and squeaked.
You are to be married, her father said, to Pyotr Vladimirovich, one of those northern boyars. He's a rich man, and he will be kind to you.
Married? But I thought, I hoped, I meant to go to a convent. I would pray for your soul, father. I wish that above all things.
Anna twisted her hands together.
Nonsense, said Ivan, brisk. You will like having sons, and Pyotr Vladimirovich is a good man. A convent is a cold place for a girl.
Cold? No, the convent was safe. Safe, blessed, a respite from her madness.
Since she could remember, Anna had wanted to take vows. Now her skin blanched in terror. She flung herself forward and caught her father's feet.
No, father, she cried. No, please, I don't want to marry.
Ivan picked her up, not unkindly, and set her on her feet.
Enough of that, he said. I have decided, and it is for the best. You will be well dowered, of course, and you will make me strong grandsons.
Anna was small and scrawny, and her stepmother's expression indicated doubt on that score.
But please, whispered Anna, what is he like?
Ask your women, said Ivan indulgently. I'm sure they'll have rumors. Wife, see that her things are in order, and for God's sake, make her bathe before the wedding.
Dismissed, Anna trudged back to her sewing, biting back sobs.
Married. Not to retreat, but to be the mistress of a lord's domain, not to be safe in a convent, but to live as some lord's breeding sow.
And the northern boyars were lusty men, the serving girl said, who dressed in skins and had hundreds of children. They were rough and warlike and, some like to say, spurned Christ and worshipped the devil. Anna pulled her pretty sarafan off over her head, shivering. If her sinful imagination conjured demons in the relative security of Moscow, what would it be like alone on the estate of a wild lord? The northern forests were haunted, the women said, and the winter lasted 8 months in 12. It did not bear thinking of. When the girl sat down again to her sewing, her hands trembled so that she could not set her stitches straight, and for all her efforts, the linen was blotched with silent tears. Chapter 7. The Meeting in the Marketplace. Pyotr Vladimirovich, unaware that his future had been agreed upon between the Grand Prince and the Metropolitan of Moscow, rose early the next morning and went to the market in Moscow's main square. His mouth tasted of old mushrooms, and his head throbbed with talk and drink. And,
foolish old man to let the boy run wild, his son wished to turn monk.
Pyotr had high hopes for Sasha. The boy was cooler-headed and cleverer than his older brother, better with horses, defter with weapons. Pyotr could imagine no greater waste than to have him disappear into a hovel, to cultivate a garden to the glory of God.
Well, he consoled himself, 15 is very young.
Sasha would come round. Piety was one thing, quite another to give up family and inheritance for deprivation and a cold bed. The din of many voices penetrated his reverie. Pyotr shook himself. The cold air reeked of horses and fires, soot and honey wine. Men with mugs dangling from their belts proclaimed the virtues of the latter beside their sticky barrels. The pasty sellers were out with their steaming trays, and the sellers of cloth and gems, wax and rare wood, honey and copper, worked bronze and golden trinkets, jostled for room. Their voices thundered up to fright the morning sun.
And Moscow has only a little market, Pyotr thought.
Sarai was the seat of the Khan. It was there the great merchants went, to sell marvels to a court jaded by 300 years of plunder. Even the markets further south, in Vladimir, or west, in Novgorod, were bigger than the one in Moscow. But merchants still trickled north from Byzantium and further east, tempted by the prices their wares fetched among the barbarians, and tempted even more by the prices the princes paid in Tsargrad for furs from the north. Pyotr could not go home empty-handed. Olga's gift was easy enough. He bought her a headdress of pearl-strewn silk to glow against her dark hair. For his three sons, he bought daggers, short but heavy, with inlaid hilts. However, try as he might, he could find nothing to give Vasilisa. She was not a girl for trinkets, for beads, or headdresses, but he could not very well give her a dagger. Frowning, Pyotr persevered and was testing the heft of gold brooches when he caught sight of a strange man. Pyotr could not have said exactly what about this man was strange, except that he had a sort of stillness striking amid the bustle. His clothes were fit for a prince, his boots richly embroidered. A knife hung at his belt, white gems sparkling at the hilt. His black curls were uncovered, odd for any man, and more so as it was white winter, brilliant sky, and snow groaning underfoot. He was clean-shaven, something all but unheard of among the Rus, and Pyotr from a distance could not tell if he was old or young. Pyotr realized he was staring and turned away, but he was curious. The jewel merchant said confidingly,
"You are curious about that man. You are not alone. He comes sometimes to the market, but no one knows who his people are."
Pyotr was skeptical.
The merchant smirked. "Truly, gospodin, he is never seen in church, and the bishop wants him stoned for idolatry. But he is rich, and he always brings the most marvelous things to trade. So the prince keeps the church quiet, and the man comes and goes away again. Perhaps he is a devil."
This was tossed off, half laughing, but then the merchant frowned.
"Never once have I seen him in the springtime. Always, always he comes in winter, at the turning of the year."
Pyotr grunted. He himself was quite open to the possibility of devils, but he was not convinced that they would stroll about markets, summer or winter, dressed in princely raiment. He shook his head, indicated a bracelet, and said,
"This is rotten stuff. Already the silver is green round the edges."
The merchant protested, and the two settled to chaffering in earnest, forgetting all about the black-haired stranger. The stranger in question halted before a market stall, not more than 10 paces from where Pyotr stood. He ran thin fingers over a heap of silk brocade. His hands alone could tell him the quality of the wares. He paid only cursory attention to the cloth before him. His pale eyes flicked here and there about the crowded market. The cloth seller watched the stranger with a sort of obsequious wariness. The merchants knew him. A few thought he was one of them. He had brought marvels to Moscow before, weapons from Byzantium, porcelain light as morning air. The merchants remembered. But this time the stranger had another purpose, else he'd never have come south. He did not like cities, and it was a risk to cross the Volga. The flashing colors and voluptuous weight of the fabric suddenly seemed tedious, and after a moment, the stranger abandoned the cloth and strode across the square. His horse stood on the south side, chewing wisps of hay. A roomy old man stood at her head, pale and thin and oddly insubstantial, though the white mare was magnificent as a rearing mountain, and her harness was tooled and chased with silver. Men stared at her with admiration as they passed. She flicked her ears like a coquette, drawing a faint smile from her rider. But suddenly, a big man with cracked fingernails appeared out of the crowd and snatched the horse's rein. Her rider's face darkened. Though his pace did not quicken, there was no need. A cold wind rippled across the square. Men snatched for hats and loosened garments. The would-be thief flung himself into the mare's saddle, and dug in his heels. But the mare did not move. Neither did her groom, oddly enough. He neither shouted nor raised a hand. He merely watched, an unreadable look in his sunken eyes. The thief lashed the mare's shoulder. She did not stir a hoof, only swished her tail. The thief hesitated a bewildered instant, and then it was too late. The mare's rider strode up and wrenched him out of the saddle. The thief might have screamed, but found his throat frozen. Gasping, he groped for the wooden cross at his throat. The other smiled without humor. "You have trespassed on what is mine. Do you think faith will save you?"
"Kosudar," the thief stammered. "I did not know. I thought..."
"That such as I do not walk in the places of men?"
"Well, I go where I will."
"Please," choked the thief. "Kosudar, I beg."
"Don't mule," said the stranger with cool humor,
"and I will leave you a while to walk free in the sun."
"However..."
The quiet voice dropped lower, and the laughter drained out of it like water from a smashed cup.
"You are marked. You are mine. And one day I shall touch you again. You will die."
The thief choked out a sobbing breath, then found himself suddenly alone, a stinging like fire in his arm and throat. Already in the saddle, though no one had seen him mount, the stranger wheeled and sent his horse through the crush. The horse's groom bowed once and melted into the crowd. The mare was light and swift and sure. Her rider's anger quieted as he rode.
"The signs led me here," said the man to his horse. "Here to this stinking city when I should not have left my own lands."
He had been in Moscow a month already, searching, tireless, face after face.
"Well, signs are not infallible," he said. "The witch's daughter is hidden from me, and her child is long gone. The hour might have passed, the hour might never come."
The mare slanted an ear back at her rider. His lips firmed.
"No," he said. "Am I so easily defeated?"
The mare went on at a steady canter. The man shook his head. He was not yet beaten. He held the magic trembling in his throat, in the hollow of his hand, ready. His answer lay somewhere in this miserable wooden city, and he would find it. He turned the mare west, urging her into a long striding gallop. The coolness among the trees would clear his head. He was not defeated. Not yet. The reek of mead and dogs, dust and humanity, greeted the stranger when he arrived at the Grand Prince's feast. Ivan's boyars were big men used to battle, and to carving life out of the land of frost. The stranger was not so large as even the smallest, but no one, not even the bravest or the drunkest, could meet his eyes, and no one offered him challenge. The stranger took a place at the high table and drank his honey wine unmolested. The silver embroidery on his caftan shone in the torchlight. One of the princess's waiting women sat beside him, gazing up through her long lashes. Lent was near and the feasting was raucous, but
"it is all the same here," thought the stranger. "All these dim, busy faces."
Sitting amid the din and the stink, he felt for the first time, not despair perhaps, but the beginning of resignation. It was then that a man walked into the hall with two grown boys. The three took places at the high table. The older man was quite ordinary, his clothes of good quality. His elder son swaggered, and the younger walked softly, his glance cool and grave, perfectly ordinary. And yet... The stranger's gaze shifted. With the three came a curling breath of wind, a wind out of the north. In the space between one breath and the next, the wind told him a tale of life and death together, of a child born with a failing year.
"The blood holds, brother," he whispered. "She lives, and I was not mistaken." His face was triumphant.
He returned to the table, though indeed he had never moved, and smiled with sudden delight into the eyes of the woman beside him.